Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. For the past 35 years, the political and earning power of America's largest class, the working class, has steadily been eroding. Now, some of that is due to global competition, but according to my guest today, it's been mostly due to big business and capital owners consciously rolling back worker gains and job security over that time. But Tamara Drought says that the American working class is beginning to awaken to its nascent power. In her book, Sleeping Giant, How the Working Class Will Transform America, she documents how the push for a living wage and organizations like Black Lives Matter are pushing lawmakers and media to quit marginalizing this class. Today's working class has changed. It's far more female and racially diverse. It includes workers like cubicle workers, retail workers, healthcare workers, along with the traditional blue-collar jobs that's typically defined working class. Tamara Drought is the Vice President for Policy and Research at Demos, a national think tank on labor and equality issues, and is also the author of the 2006 book, Strapped, Why America's 20 and 30-somethings Can't Get Ahead. She'll be speaking tonight at a discussion sponsored by the Oklahoma Policy Institute and BookSmart Tulsa. That gets underway this evening at 7 o'clock at the Woody Guthrie Center, and the event is free and open to the public. Tamara Drought joins me today by phone. Tamara Drought, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Rich.
Yeah, you write in The Sleeping Giant that you're looking at this major American class that has been overlooked and sort of marginalized for the better part of 30 or 40 years, but you're saying that America's working class, in fact, it's a majority of American workers, are beginning to recognize that they too have political and economic power. How are they beginning to assert this power?
I talk in the book about three big movements that are really of, by, and for working class people. The one that is I think, the most obvious is the Fight for 15, where you have this new working class, service sector workers, fast food, retail, really making a demand and actually being successful in getting the minimum wage raised in, you know, major cities and states. So the Fight for 15 is one. I think in the immigrant rights movement, you also have this, particularly looking at the success of the Dreamers in pushing legislation so that undocumented young people can get in-state tuition at public universities and colleges. And then finally, Black Lives Matter. And that is a movement that is really weaving together both issues of racial oppression and police brutality to the economic exclusion of so many African-American communities in this country. So I think those three movements really do represent a beginning resurgence of this new working class's political power.
But really, it is just a start, is it not?
It is just a start, absolutely. And, you know, we often forget that one of the demands of Fight for 15 is, you know, $15 and a union. And I think that's the piece that, you know, it has yet to come together, but is part of the campaign, and I think definitely part of what this new working class sees as needed to begin getting the kind of economic and political power that the old white, industrial, mostly male working class enjoyed.
It seems like it was not too long ago, maybe within the last 20 or 30 years, where people really didn't want to talk about working class. They wanted to talk about middle class. In fact, there was a perception that the working class themselves didn't want to be referred to as working class, but middle class. But we're seeing such erosion of the middle class. Are people beginning to talk about a working class as being every bit as a part of the American fabric of life as every other class?
You know, it's interesting. I think one of the greatest myths that has been propagated politically is this idea that everybody identifies as middle class. And if you actually look at polls that have been done, there's a longstanding, very reputable poll called the General Social Survey that has been asking people to self-identify whether they consider themselves lower, working, middle, or upper class. And, you know, over the last 25, 30 years, the percentage split between working class and middle class is about even. And so what's really interesting is that the only demographic group that a minority identify as working class is actually white people.
And makes sense.
Which is what is so interesting, because every 4 years, we actually do begin to have a little bit of a conversation about the working class, but it's almost entirely, as it is again this election year, about the white working class. And so we continue to have a very narrow conversation about working class issues. It still is largely focused on issues of trade and manufacturing and less focused on how we are going to create good jobs in the fields that are actually booming, like health services, like childcare workers, like retail and fast food. Those are really still the jobs of the future, and those are the jobs that are going to add the most to the economy. But that isn't really part of the conversation that we have at the national level when it comes to the working class.
You've just touched on another sort of myth, if you will, that's been out there, that this century was going to be the century where everyone was going to have a college degree to compete for any job. But the reality is very different. Working class jobs are the most abundant jobs being created in those four categories that you talked about. Why is this myth that I think you're right, that the promise of these very high-tech, high-skilled jobs are going to transform the economy has not panned out so far?
No, it hasn't. And if you look at sort of what gets written about by opinion writers and in the economy pages, it's really about sort of this massive transformation to a knowledge economy. And we tend to, you know, lift that up. It's interesting. These are, you know, the people who are innovating and giving us things that have changed our lives, like Twitter and Facebook and all of that, all of which is good stuff. But those jobs pale in comparison to the numbers of jobs being created every year in what is now a very low-paid segment of the labor market, and that is all of these service sector jobs. And so I think, you know, there is a bit of a, I call it a cocoon, that our policymakers, that our culture makers, that our news makers live in. And the reality is, as, you know, the increasing education of our policymakers, our newsmakers, our cultural makers, means that we are, as a society, much more isolated from people who are different than us. And that is true in terms of both race and class. So it's rarer and rarer for somebody who is a Congress member or a staffer of a Congress member to have any real connection to a working class family or a working class household. And so I think that, you know, people write about what they know, and these days, you know, the people who have made it into journalism, into Congress and the staff of Congress are highly educated individuals with no real connection to working class issues.
You know, that to me is, you've struck the nail on the head. This is, I think, one of our big challenges this century is, you know, we've lost a lot of the ways in which a person that is highly educated and was the family that they grew up in was at the top of the income scale, having contact with people from a different class, really. I mean, at one point you had military service. Somewhat you had at one point in higher education, when higher education was a lot cheaper, you might have had something there. Neighborhoods where there was mixed class neighborhoods gave you some insight. Those are all pretty much disappearing, are they not?
Yeah, they really are. And I talk in the book, so I grew up in a blue-collar working-class family. But, you know, on my block were accountants, there were marketing executives, there were teachers, and then there were steelworkers like my dad and another friend who lived across the street from me. And so it was this real, you know, just one block of many different classes, professional, working class. And that has really been upset, as you mentioned something really important, as higher ed has become much more expensive. What we know is the biggest predictor of somebody getting a college degree is if their parents had college degrees. So what that means is today's college-educated people in their 40s and 50s were much more likely to grow up in college-educated households. So again, that means you don't have this experience of upward mobility, of moving from working class to the professional class that you might have had a generation ago when the first baby boomers were really, we saw the big increase in college attainment for that generation. It's now higher ed is actually solidifying privilege as opposed to working as, you know, one of the primary levers of actual social and upward mobility.
Is that, I mean, when I think of in the 1940s, I think of the GI Bill, which opened up higher education to a whole generation of people who probably had never attained a four-year degree.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And it's one of the reasons why the United States is number one in the world in terms of having the highest educated older population. Number one, 65 and older, we have the best educated population in the world. We're 15th for people who are 25 to 34. And one of the reasons why is we have really stopped investing at the state level in our universities and colleges. You know, I went to a state university. It costs a third of what it does today, that same university. And you think about, not only did my parents have more purchasing power as a working class couple than a working class couple does today, but we also invested in state universities so that they cost a third of what they did today. So, you know, I really think about my own chances. Would I be, you know, writing a book, talking to you, you know, doing a radio interview if I was 18 in a working class household today trying to make my way through higher education, which now requires $30,000 in debt? I'm not sure. You know, the reality is it was pretty easy for me to, like, climb that ladder and go to college. I graduated in 4 years without any debt. And I think that those opportunities are just not available for today's working class young people like they were when I was growing up.
So in the book, you talk about this class as being the sleeping giant that is maybe beginning to arouse from its slumber. How does the new working class today differ from, say, the what we would determine as a working class, say, two generations ago, maybe in the post-war period, mm-hmm. or maybe prior to the post-war when you had the industrial age? How does the new working class differ?
So I think, you know, our conception of the working class hasn't really caught up yet with reality. You know, I think when you talk about working class people, people still conjure up in their head, when you say working class, somebody like my dad, you know, white man, hard hat,
steel worker,
the whole nine yards, sort of a blue collar industrial worker, factory worker. That isn't the working class anymore today. And it's really shifted from people who make stuff to people who serve or care for people. These jobs are much more likely to be filled by women and much more likely to be filled by people of color. And so one of the things I talk about is that has led to an invisibility of this working class as an actual sort of class of people with real shared political and cultural identity. It's a much more diffuse working class, right? There isn't that center of gravity. Manufacturing, there isn't the equivalent of manufacturing, which was, you know, 25 to a third of our economy back then. Today it's retail and fast food and home health aides and janitorial services and just a whole range of occupations and types of jobs, which also makes it hard to sort of pin down who is this new working class when there isn't sort of this, you know, archetype that you can draw on like we could a generation, two generations ago, and really hold up sort of, you know, the blue-collar white man as the archetype of the working class.
And a lot of those, at least in food and retail, we thought of those as sort of entry gateway jobs, and now they become means to an end.
That's exactly right. That's another example where, again, our conception hasn't quite caught up with reality. You know, those used to be jobs that high school kids had, that maybe you worked summers in between college, those kinds of things. But the reality is today these are jobs that people are in and trying to take care of themselves and their families on wages that hover, you know, anywhere between minimum wage, which is $7.25 at the federal level, you know, to $10 to $12 an hour. And so we haven't seen yet in this political debate a real commitment to making all of those jobs decent jobs.
Now, when you defined working class, you kind of said, you had to come up with a definition. And basically, what you determined was it's people working in the workforce that do not have college degrees. Is that perhaps the best measure?
Well, you know, there are social scientists that debate how to define the working class in many different ways. I think, you know, another way to look at it is by occupation, whether you have sort of autonomy and authority in your job. Any way you do it, though, and I've looked at if you do it by occupation, you end up with roughly the same amount, which is about two-thirds of the workforce are working class, whether you define that as people who don't have four-year college degrees or don't have any kind of real autonomy or creative control over the work they do. And so it is, you know, the majority. I mean, America has always been a working class country. We are not close to getting to a place where the majority of people have four-year college degrees. So I think it's valid to look at it by education, and the reason I did that was so that I could look at both political data and economic data and be able to use the same measurement of working class.
There are probably occupations that are now really classified as working class. If you told a person who holds that job, they would say, I don't think that's correct. And I'm thinking of people like secretaries and administrative assistants, clerks, customer mm-hmm. service representatives working, you know, in the big call room. Those are working class jobs now.
And they are. And most likely the people, you know, I interviewed bank tellers and customer service representatives, and they certainly identified themselves as working class. You know, this has been one of the great divergences of the last 30 years is the quality of life that is available between people with college degrees, with 4 years degrees, and without them. You know, the quality of your housing, your income, your wealth, all of that has really diverged quite sharply between people who have bachelor's degrees and people who don't. And most of it is because the job quality for people who don't have bachelor's degrees we've let it really plummet. And so it's not so much that at average a bachelor's degree holder is making so much more than they did 3 decades ago. It's actually because everybody else is making so much less, and that is particularly true for men without college degrees.
What about the other sort of issue that shows up in a lot of economic stories, that people with college degrees that are taking working class jobs because they can't find jobs within their profession, or they're not going to go to graduate school or something like that? Is that transforming the working class as well in any sort of definitive number way?
You know, it's interesting. I think that it depends on what you're looking at. If you're looking at unemployment, definitely having a college degree is a great insurance plan against being unemployed for a long period of time. I do think we do have a serious issue with people getting degrees and not getting on a career path. That does seem to be changing a little bit as the economy is rebounding. But, you know, if you look at the returns to a college degree, the sad reality is that the returns and the unemployment rates are much higher for African-American college graduates than they are for white college graduates. So we continue to have sort of this racial difference in the returns to education. And, you know, you can look at discrimination in the labor market, which is, you know, sadly well proven. I talk about this in the book. The resume tests they do, where you send out resumes with names that sound, you know, typically white, like Michelle or John, compared to resumes with typical African-American sounding names like LaShawn, and the white sounding names get called back at a much higher rate. So college is not a silver bullet. It is a necessity, but not a guarantee of upward mobility.
My guest today is Tamara Drought, Vice President of Policy and Research at Demos, a national think tank, and the author of Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Earlier, you were talking about the invisibility of this class because it is more women, more people of color in this class. And one of the things you do is you outline some of the common indignities and working conditions that today are taken for granted. But, you know, if you compare that to a generation ago, this would have been something that would put people up in arms. Things like working off the clock, overlooking health and safety violations, on-call working, independent contracting, where you're really working for an employer. How has this changed working conditions?
This has been a really big shift, I think, in the quality of employment. You know, it's gotten to the point where disrespect is really baked into today's working class jobs, and you really hit on some of the key ways. So one is erratic scheduling, you know, being scheduled a day or two in advance or being expected to be on call at any time. And you can imagine if you actually are raising a family that can wreak havoc on childcare arrangements. And also, just even if you don't, it wreaks havoc on your ability to budget because you know how many hours you're going to be working on any given week. The other thing that has happened is the use of contracting and subcontracting, where you have, with every new contract, you have the lead company and then they hire out a subcontractor and then that subcontractor hires out another subcontractor. What happens is that depresses wages all the way down because the last person in that chain has little left to work with, and so they have to squeeze whatever profit they can by often cutting corners. And that's cutting corners. It can be around safety and not providing the kind of safety equipment or procedures necessary to do, for example, a construction job safely. So it's rampant, you know, wage theft, which is either not paying folks for overtime or not paying them for their hours they've worked. You know, Walmart had a huge settlement about making people clock out and continue working off the clock. So, you know, some of our most recognizable global brands, you know, repeatedly are found to be violating minimum wage and overtime laws.
And there's a couple of efforts. You mentioned the flexible scheduling. There's now there's a move to sort of make this on-call scheduling and working less likely in a lot of workplaces. There's also the Wage and Hour Board decision that will significantly move up the area where you're prone to overtime, doubling that wage earning threshold. Is this a major step forward, do you think? Or
yeah, I think the overtime rules are pretty significant, actually, because what has happened is the threshold is doubling. It's going up to around $47,000. And if you earn less than that, you will be eligible for overtime pay. Prior to that, what we were seeing happening is a lot of employers were sort of flouting overtime laws by categorizing low-paid positions as managers. So you could be a frontline manager at McDonald's making 10 bucks an hour, essentially doing the same job as the cashier next to you, but because you had a management title, you were no longer eligible for overtime. So if you worked 50 hours, you still got paid, you know, your $24,000 a year, and you didn't get time and a half. So by moving the threshold up, it increases the percentage of the workforce that's eligible for overtime, and that can... The good thing for workers is that will either result in them earning more money, getting paid for the extra hours they're working above 40, or they might actually get some leisure time back, which is good. But either way, they're better off. They're either getting leisure time or they're getting more money. They're not getting less money in any of those circumstances. So it is. I think it's pretty transformative.
Now, one of the things when you read through Sleeping Giant, these case stories that you write about, it's like obviously this job class needs a union. And in certain places of the country, that's beginning to happen again after unionism being basically changed to a four-letter word in a lot of quarters around the country. But in many places, many of this class still reject unionism. What do you think is going to change some workers' minds on that?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, there have been some studies that show that, you know, the majority of workers would like to join a union if they had the option. I think one of the things that has really increased is the use of what are called union avoidance firms union busting firms. You know, all of the major, any Fortune 500 company is going to hire a union avoidance firm as soon as they get a whiff that there are workers trying to organize their work site. And so, you know, employers actually have the upper hand when it comes to a union drive. It is very hard to organize a union under today's laws. And the reason why is employers have the option to hold what are called captive audience meetings. They can require their workers, their employees, to sit through a meeting where somebody goes through and basically puts the fear of God in them about what would happen if a union was brought in. Unions don't have that option. They don't have the right to be at the workplace, on site, talking to workers. So, you know, the upper hand is to employers, and they use it very effectively in terms of beating back union drives. It's become very hard. And then we have whole sections of the country that have what are known as so-called right-to-work laws, which make it financially very difficult for unions to be successful because it basically allows workers to say, I want to be covered by your contract, but I don't want to pay union dues. So it allows people to opt out, which basically means you have a lot of workers who will free ride, and at the end of the day, that's not financially viable for the union who has to pay, you know, to do all of the collective bargaining on behalf of all the workers. So we've got a real problem in this country in terms of, on paper, you know, we believe in economic democracy, and there's supposed to be a set of processes and procedures to allow workers to unionize. But the reality is it is often a David and Goliath battle, and workers often get outmaneuvered and outspent significantly when they try and organize a union.
Now, a central thesis of your book, The Sleeping Giant, is that this sleeping giant is beginning to rouse. Do you think it is the fight for the $15 wage, the living wage, if you will, that's starting to happen on the coast and other places that will sort of rouse this giant?
I think it absolutely is. And if you look, it's not just the Seattles and Los Angeles and, you know, now New York State, the entire state, is moving to a $15 minimum wage. So I think that it is and has really changed the conversation about work in this country and has put on the table the idea that we need to increase the minimum wage in this country, that there are lots of jobs that pay a poverty wage that we subsidize through, you know, Medicaid and food stamps. And these are, you know, often very wealthy corporations who could be paying their workers much more than they currently are. And so what the minimum wage does is it levels the playing field so that, you know, a Walmart can't undercut the entire industry by pushing wages down, which is what has happened in retail. So I think the Fight for 15 has been a huge success, not only in actually winning raises for millions of workers already, but for really changing what is considered acceptable in terms of wages in this country.
When you look at the history of labor relations in our country, we, you know, up until about 1900, certainly all the impetus was on management, and then you had workers reasserting their rights, oftentimes collectively through unionism, and you saw these jobs earning more benefits, better pay, and somewhere around the 1960s and 70s, all of a sudden the pendulum swung the other way. Do you think that the pendulum is beginning to turn, or is this still going to be a long, long fight? Because, you know, you remember the last time workers asserted their rights, you know, it was bloody and it was violent.
That's
in many
right.
cases.
And it's a really a forgotten piece of our history. And I think this shows up in the focus on bringing back manufacturing jobs as kind of this silver bullet that will help revive job quality and bring good quality jobs here again. And what I think that misses is that, you know, in its heyday, those manufacturing jobs weren't, you know, in and of themselves magically good jobs. They became good jobs when people actually fought for the right to unionize those jobs. And as you say, it was bloody. And a lot of people gave their lives or got hurt in that fight. And so we've forgotten that economic democracy was like bitterly contested, always has been, and we have been in a period where the rights of corporations and the wealthy have really dominated, and the power and the ability for unions to organize workers has been decimated. I think it is starting to swing back, but I think we have to, you know, be realistic and say, you know, this has really been undone over three decades of very intense and aggressive organizing by businesses, by major multinational companies to be able to write the rules of the game in their favor and against that of workers. And we're not going to turn it around in one election or two elections, but I do think that if you look at people hitting the streets, calling for more pay, calling for a union, calling for an end to economic exclusion by race, we're getting there. We are starting to say, you know, it is time we get back to a more decent way of living and that corporations pay their fair share.
Tamara Drought, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you, Rich.
Tamara Drought is the Vice President for Policy and Research at the Public Policy Institute, DEMOS. She's worked on household indebtedness, middle-class insecurity, and the economic challenges facing young people. Her new book is titled Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America. It's published by Doubleday. And she'll be a guest of the Oklahoma Policy Institute, as well as Booksmart Tulsa this evening at 7 o'clock at the Woody Guthrie Center. The event is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.